It's late in the evening in the Three Steps pub in the small village of Drumontee in the Northern Irish county of Armagh. A stranger has come into the pub, saying that he is a member of the official IRA from West Belfast. He mingles with the locals, and at one stage he leaps up on stage to sing a Republican song in front of an amused crowd. But something isn't right. His story doesn't make sense, and as the night wears down, he begins to attract the wrong type of attention. As it turns out, this stranger is Captain Robert Nyrack, a British Army officer specialising in intelligence. And right now, he was alone in an extremely Republican part of Northern Ireland, pretending to be a member of the IRA. Shortly after leaving the pub, things for Nyrack took a turn for the worse, and in this episode we will learn about Nyrack and what happened to him on that fateful night. This is the Troubles Podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. During the 30-year period of violence known as the Troubles, there are many examples of informers, double agents, and undercover agents. The intel that these agents could uncover proved to be essential to the British security services in their battle against paramilitaries. All of these roles carried an incredible amount of secrecy due to the danger involved. If any of these people were uncovered, it could often lead to a violent and brutal execution, so that an example would be made of them. One that has always stood out for its brutality and intrigue is the case of British Army officer Robert Nyrack. Nyrack is one of 16 people who has gone on to become known as the Disappeared. The Disappeared are people who were abducted, murdered, and secretly buried in Northern Ireland. I've spoken about them before, as Jean McConville was one of them. As of writing in 2021, 13 bodies of people who were disappeared have been recovered, sometimes decades after they went missing. But Nyrack's body is one of the three that has never been found. So who exactly was he, and why was he disappeared? Robert Nyrack was born in 1948 on the island of Mauritius in Africa, which was then a British colony. He was born to an English mother and a French Mauritian father. He was the youngest of four children and raised in a devout Catholic household. It was this upbringing that was to be a key feature in Nyrack's alleged ability to understand the grievances of the nationalists and the Catholic community. Nyrack was raised in North Yorkshire when he then enrolled in Oxford University in 1967. He excelled in rugby and was also particularly good at boxing. One of Nyrack's closest friends, Martin Squires, claimed in Alistair Kerr's book, Betrayal, that Nyrack was a man who was charming, polite, and captivating, and that people were just drawn to him. Squires also said in the book that Nyrack had a ruthless streak and could explode in violent outbursts, and that he never backed down from a fight. Squires claims that he saw Nyrack knock a cab driver out over a trivial argument over a fare. Alistair Kerr goes on to mention in his book, once whilst out walking through London, Nyrack was followed by four young punk skinheads, which were a symbol of right-wing politics in the 80s. They confronted him and asked if he'd like to fight. Nyrack's response was to cheerfully answer, "Yes, I would," before subsequently putting the two of them in hospital. A former school girlfriend, Mary Price, claims in Angela Duffy's book, Ireland's Informers, that Nyrack said to her a year before his death that because he was Roman Catholic and knew Ireland and was a key part of the army, he could bring the warring sides together. In 1971, Nyrack enlisted to Sandhurst Military Academy, and he eventually joined the Grenadier Guards. In 1973, Nyrack went on his first tour of Northern Ireland, and there, according to his colleagues, he threw himself wholesale, forming bonds with the community of Ardoyne and West Belfast, going as far to form an amateur boxing league for the local kids in the area. The tour of the Grenadier Guards was deemed a success. They didn't lose any soldiers, nor did they fire their weapons. They did acquire over 600 pounds of explosive material and arrested over 100 men suspected of being members of the Provisional IRA. Nyrack was so immersed in his role in Northern Ireland that he deferred the opportunity to travel to Hong Kong with his regiment in order to go back to Northern Ireland. But it would be his next role that would shroud him in mystery. In 1974, Nyrack joined the 14th Intelligence Unit and would serve as a liaison officer between the RUC, the SAS, and higher command of the British Army. Just a little clarification here, the RUC were the Northern Irish Police Force, and the SAS were an elite-trained unit of the British Army. To this day, due to classified information, the exact nature of his role cannot be fully clarified. In the words of one anonymous soldier, known only as Connor, quote, "We didn't truly know what his role was or who he belonged to. He went where it seemed he wanted to go." What we do know, according to some sources, is that at Bessbrook, underneath his bed, he had a multitude of berets. A fawn beret of the elite SAS, a feathered beret of the Argyll Highlanders, who were a regular regiment of the British Army stationed in Northern Ireland. He also possessed a black beret of the Provisional IRA. To this day, it is still unclear why Nairac would have multiple berets. We do know that Nairac had multiple aliases and was known by different names to different communities. To the Republican community and the Provisionals, he was known as Danny McArlan, or Danny Boy. The UDR was an infantry regiment of the British Army, which at this point was heavily infiltrated with Loyalists. To them, he was known as Charlie MacDonald. Kerr claims that in one instance, Nairac was seen speaking on the phone with a Scottish accent, which led one genuine Scot soldier to ask, "Is that guy really a Highlander?" To the Loyalists in Ardoyne, he was known as Charles Johnson. What passed between Nairac and these paramilitaries, none have come forward to clarify. But between 1974 and his death, Nairac's movements would be shrouded in secrecy, and during that time, there were allegations that he was linked to some of the darkest chapters of the Troubles. One of the most infamous cases that he is linked to is the Miami Showband Massacre, which was covered in episode 2 of this podcast. On the 31st of July 1975, the Showband were on their way home from a show when they were stopped by Loyalists disguised as UDR soldiers. The Loyalists ordered them out of the van, and two Loyalists were in the process of planting a bomb in the back of the van when it exploded, prematurely killing the two men. The remaining Loyalists then opened fire on the band members, killing three. Band member Stephen Travers claims that he remembers a handsome British soldier at the scene, with a broken nose and fair hair, but he can't say for certain if it was Nairac or not. Indeed, Nairac did have a broken nose through boxing, but was renowned as being very dark with Italianite appearance. Friends and historians have dismissed these claims. Alistair Kerr writes that it would make no military sense to risk Robert, a valuable intelligence asset, on such a dangerous attack. As well as that, a close friend of Nairac claimed he was trout fishing with them in Scotland at the time of the attack. By 1977, Nairac was now fully immersed in the world of intelligence and espionage, moving between the Loyalist and Republican paramilitaries, liaising between the UDR and the SAS. One SAS man, Stephen Collett, claims that Nairac was becoming obsessed with his role. This became a concern to colleagues and superiors, as it was now seeming that he was undergoing fatigue or burnout. It became evident that Nairac was starting to take too many chances by trying to maintain multiple aliases in different parts of the province. In the words of one former colleague, quote, "In places like Afghanistan and Iraq, you can move around, but in Northern Ireland, your face is going to be known after a while. You can't be in uniform in Armagh one day, and then in a leather jacket with Siggy's and a Guinness in Belfast the next." It appears that Nairac's friends and family were aware of the dangers that he faced. In one instance, he was on leave back in England just before he resumed the rest of his tour, and his friends and family pleaded with him not to go back. In the words of his friend Malins, quote, "We went for dinner in London, a group of us, and Robert told us over drinks that he'd been working undercover. We were horrified. He then told us he was going back to South Armagh, and I don't know why, but I just knew then I was looking at a dead man." It wasn't just friends and family either who thought that Nairac was becoming unsafe. In one article written by Alan Judd in his review of Kerr's book, he claims that an SAS man known as G told Colonel Fairweather, quote, "We have to pull Robert out. He's knackered and taking too many chances. And when you get this confident, you think you're untouchable." Edinburgh man Colonel Clive Fairweather was at this time General Staff Commander of the shadowy GSO2 14th Intelligence, and subsequent commander of the SAS division attached to this unit. His relationship with Nairac was complicated to say the least, but we'll come to that later. Because of the nature of his role and the subsequent secrecy of it, it is near impossible to pin down the date of Nairac's entrance into the 14th Intelligence Unit, and what his key missions and duties were. What we do know is that he worked in liaison with different units, the Army, the SAS, the RUC, and the UDR. We'll get back to Nairac, but first I want to explain a little bit about the village where the night in question occurred. The village of Drumontee is a small rural community in the northern Irish county of Armagh, close to Jonesboro. To its west sits the town of Crossmaglen, traditionally a Republican stronghold, and to its north lay the towns of Newry and Dundalk. The town itself is only 2 kilometres north from the border of the Republic of Ireland. Drumontree lies at the heart of Republican South Armagh, and 30 years ago even the word South Armagh would strike fear in the heart of a British soldier. I've talked about this in Season 1. This is where the South Armagh Sniper Brigade operated, and a number of British soldiers fell victims to snipers operating in the area. There was also a point which soldiers could only travel via helicopter because it was too dangerous to travel on foot or in a vehicle. During the Troubles, over 165 British Forces personnel would lose their lives, and the RUC recorded that there were over 1,225 bomb attacks and 1,580 shootings within a 9-mile radius of South Armagh. The IRA was indeed dangerous, but they also had some serious problems when it came to levels of infiltration that went on by the British Army. In all levels of the IRA, top to bottom, there were informers. As a result of this, the Republican brigades had to fragment into smaller active service units, and they would only be aware of their small role in each overall operation, not the operation as a whole. But the South Armagh Brigade were different. They were so tight-knit and knew each other so well that they didn't have to fragment down like other brigades. The night in question is May 14th, 1977. The Troubles are in full swing. A British Army watchtower known as Baruchy Sanger with its heavy machine guns looms over Crossmaglen. The United Unionist Strike, a workers' strike from the Unionist Loyalist community, has just come to an end and was considered a success. The Provisional IRA have intensified their efforts in targeting Northern Irish businessmen with the assassinations of factory managers James Nicholson and Donald Robinson. The Shankill Butchers have claimed their latest victim, Francis Cassidy, found on a grass verge with his throat slashed. But on this hot summer's Saturday night at the packed Three Steps pub, the Eddie Murphy Band from Crossmaglen start up their set, and the violence and fear is miles away from the minds of the locals. The pub is packed, as the patrons from nearby villages cram in for their weekend pints. But there was one man unfamiliar to the locals in the bar. He was standing at the bar singing loudly. He was a tall, handsome man, wearing a heavy leather donkey jacket, with brown bushy hair and thick mutton chop sideburns and flared jeans. When asked who he was over a pint, the stranger introduced himself as Danny McErlin from Belfast, a self-proclaimed member of the original IRA, often referred to as stickies by the provisionals. In reality, and unbeknownst to the locals, Danny was Captain Robert Nairac. So the question is, what was he doing alone in a Republican pub in Crossmaglen? All was well in the pub, and it was nearing about 10:30 at night. The band was playing and the pints were flowing. Nairac was in conversation with a few of the young men leaning against the bar, and it has been alleged that at this point something seemed amiss. John Parker is the author of the book Secret Hero, which is a book which details the life of Nairac and his achievements. In that book, one of the locals who was there that night in the pub, but wanted to remain anonymous, said, quote, "I heard him ask one of the lads, while lighting a cigarette, what route he could use if he wanted to get across the border and avoid any army checkpoints, and that instantly got my antenna up." The young men he was talking to would later be identified as Terence McCormack, Owen Rocks, Danny O'Rourke, Thomas Morgan, Jared Farron, and Patrick Maguire, who were all Republican sympathisers. However, in court it was later revealed that only O'Rourke and Farron were fully initiated members of the Provisional IRA, and at best were only the lowest rung of the brigade. The night continued, and at one point the confident Nairac leapt up on the stage and, to the delight of the locals, sang the Broad Black Brimmer, a song renowned in Republican circles commemorating a young boy trying on his father's hat to fight the British in the 1920s. It was during this song that the tone appeared to shift in the bar, and for some men at the bar, curiosity turned to cold suspicion. Edmund Murphy, the band's bassist, claimed that when Nyrac was singing on stage, the young men leaning against the bar were not singing along with him, but watching him intently. Another key aspect that was arousing suspicion about the charismatic Nyrac was that while this Saturday night it was warmer than usual, most of the patrons were wearing light shirts and light jumpers. Yet Nyrac stood out for wearing a thick leather donkey jacket, leading them to believe that he may have been concealing something. We do know that Nyrac arrived at the pub with a 9mm Browning pistol, but it was either outside in his car or it was concealed on his person. I've seen conflicting sources. At one point during the night, the young men who were suspicious of Nyrac asked a local girl to dance with him. She tried to get him up and put her arms around him, and he kindly pushed her off, which increased their suspicion. After Nyrac got down off the stage, no one can truly verify what happens next. But various sources claim that he fell back into conversation with the young men at the bar. And when asked what he was doing at this pub, he replied that he was asked to come and meet a certain member of the Provisional IRA called Seamus Murphy. It's been alleged that at this point, Nyrac sealed his fate. For Seamus Murphy was well known, and it was also well known that he had renounced forceful republicanism and was working with the youths in South Armagh in order to keep them away from paramilitaries. This in turn meant that he was instantly outlawed in the Republican Three Steps pub. Nyrac didn't seem to know this, yet the men he was speaking to did, and suddenly it became clear that this Danny McErlin from Belfast was lying and he was not who he claimed to be. So the question was, who was he? As the night was drawing to a close, many residents noted men outside the pub looking at the license plates on the cars outside. As the pub was emptying out and the band were packing up, Danny remained at the bar in conversation with the young men. The conversation had changed from audibly live banter to now tense whispered talks. Sensing a change in atmosphere, one of the band members appealed to Nyrac to come back with them for a pint, but Nyrac waved them off and chose to stay with the men. What follows? There remains no concrete evidence, but only the testimony of witnesses and participants. According to Alistair Kerr, as the band were driving away from the pub, they could see through the rear window of the van, Nyrac and the five men in the car park shouting and trading blows. This was not an unusual sight at the end of a night in a small town pub. So away they drove, unaware that what was taking place in the car park of the Three Steps pub was no ordinary pub brawl but a man fighting for his life. Alistair Kerr writes in his book Betrayal, "The men rushed Nyrac outside the pub, and then they discovered that he was no easy task. Nyrac fought like a madman and knocked three of them to the floor with ferocious punches. They didn't know he was a champion boxer. Some blood and teeth belonging to the young men was later found in the car park. During the struggle, Nyrac broke free of his attackers and ran towards his car, a red Toledo Triumph. Then came the sound of something heavy and metallic hitting the tarmac. "He's got a fucking gun," someone shouted. Nyrac just made it to his car and pulled the driver door open. Inside his car was a radio, with which he could use to contact Bessbrook Station and shout for help, but it wasn't to be. According to Kerr, Nyrac was pulled away from his car and a bronze Ford Cortina pulled up, in which two young Provisional IRA members, Liam Towson and Kevin Crilly, stepped out. They walked up to the group of men who were beating Nyrac senseless. The beating stopped when Towson pulled out a .32 Harrington revolver and placed it against Nyrac's head and said quietly, "Don't fucking move." Nyrac was dragged towards Towson's Cortina and shoved in the back. Others jumped in and the rest jumped into another car that was supposedly driven by either McCormack or Fearon. Both cars then drove south into the Republic towards Ravensdale in County Louth. After a brief journey, the two cars now reached Ravensdale Wood in County Louth. It was now midnight. What followed will never truly be known, and it has been alleged by some that the testimony heard in court was a far more sanitised version of what happened. But what took place can only be described as a savage beating. Later on, blood-soaked mud and clumps of hair were found. Claire writes that the men who numbered 9 circled Nyrac, and in the words of friend Nicky Curtis, they volleyed him like a fucking volleyball. There's one account that one of the men was striking him with a wooden plank while the other was pistol whipping him. he was questioned over and over again. Who are you? Are you SAS? There's an account saying that his face was covered in blood and he was mumbling, trying to protect his face with his hands. Liam Towson would later recount to the RUC. He just said he was Danny McErlan and that he was an official from Belfast. He never gave anything up. What a brave soldier. Nairac, he claimed, never once veered from his original story. After a brutal beating, Nairac once again, according to Terence McCormack, made an attempt to strike one of his attackers before trying to escape again. However, he was brought to the muddy ground. Kerr claims that Nairac began to murmur, asking for a priest. Then McCormack kneeled down to Nairac and pretended to be a priest, offering absolution if only he revealed his identity and purpose. Yet all he said, according to McCormack, was "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned." And the men knew it was all they were going to get. At this point, according to McCormack, Liam Towson, the 24-year-old low-ranking hitman for the Provisionals, approached Nairac. He then placed the barrel of Nairac's gun against his head and pulled the trigger. Nairac died 3 months shy of his 29th birthday. Let's just take a small step back and ask, where was Nairac's support? In the eyes of the security forces, a British serviceman has not checked in and has gone missing in Northern Ireland. It would be another 2 hours before a search helicopter was in the sky, and it wouldn't be until 6 a.m. when over 300 infantry, 100 RUC officers, and a division of SAS soldiers would be looking for him. It's serious enough when a soldier goes missing and possibly killed, but Nairac also had an extremely intimate knowledge of British security operations. If any of that information was obtained, it would be disastrous for security forces. Time really was of the essence. It is believed that Nairac informed his colleagues that he was going to Three Steps Pub and that he would be back by 11:30 p.m. at the latest. By 12:15 a.m. there was no sign of him. Nairac's commanding officer, Sergeant Collett, then notified Colonel Major Clive Fairweather that Nairac had gone out, alone, and not returned. Nairac also declined a support contingency of Sherwood Foresters infantry who were stationed in an empty building conducting surveillance just a mile east of the pub. In theory, a search operation for Nairac should have begun once he had not checked back into base at 11:30 p.m, especially if he was privy to sensitive intel. Despite this, Colonel Fairweather waited until 3 a.m. before sending up a search helicopter, and it wasn't until 6 a.m. that infantry were sent out. Fairweather passed away in 2012 and never explained the reason behind his decisions. Maybe it would have been too unsafe to send out infantry into South Armagh at night time, but there also is another theory. In the Scottish Daily Mail in 2012, Fairweather stated, quote, "Robert was not in the SAS. He was a maverick, but it was foolish for him to go from village to village with a different Irish accent and to go to the heart of rebel country as well." Fairweather continued, "He didn't deserve to die the death he did." There was also another account of Fairweather speaking quite crudely of Nairac. While attending a conference called Alternatives to Prisoners in 2006, Fairweather fell into discussion with former Longkesh prisoner Anthony McIntyre. When asked what his thoughts on Nairac were, Fairweather replied with, quote, "Nairac? He was a stupid cunt." Another reason why Fairweather possibly delayed the search for Nairac is that this wasn't Nairac's first time returning late to base. In the previous year, he had been disciplined for going trout fishing in the Republic without notifying his superiors. And on another occasion, Nairac, while on tour in Crossmaglen, took his soldiers into a Republican pub for a pint. Then after drinks, he dismissed his soldiers to head back to base, whilst he debated Irish history with the locals, much to the fury of his superiors. People who knew Nairac said that he didn't respect Fairweather because, in his opinion, Fairweather didn't understand Ireland the way he did. One SAS man said anonymously to Alistair Kerr, quote, "We never went looking for him straight away because God knows what he was doing. He could be screwing some lady somewhere, or he could have been bait, or his car could have been booby-trapped and we were left in the dark again, and Nairac endangered the lives of a lot of our guys." In the words of another SAS captain, Ken Connor, who stated in his book Ghost Force, quote, "Had he been an SAS member, he would have not been allowed to operate in the way he did. Before his death, we had been very concerned at the lack of checks on his activities. No one seemed to know who his boss was, and he appeared to have been allowed to get out of control, deciding himself what tasks he would do. Again, these are damning testimonies, but they should have not been a factor in the sluggish response to Find Nairak. Nairak told his superiors exactly where he would be and when he would be back, so the question does remain. Would a swifter search response have prevented his execution? Alistair Kerr writes in his book that the killing is presumed to have taken place sometime between 2 a.m. and 3 a.m. that night, but remember, it was in Louth. Whatever the answer, what can't be denied is the poor relationship between Nairak and Special Forces. We'll never truly be able to confirm the nature of Nairak's role during the Troubles. It is believed that he went to the pub to meet a contact who didn't show up. Another key question is, why did Nairak refuse backup? I mentioned earlier that there was a contingent of soldiers only 1 mile away. Had they been monitoring Nairak when the fight broke out, they could have gone in and rescued him. One possible reason is that Nairak was working undercover. If rescued by British forces, all his aliases and espionage gains would have gone up in smoke. Another possibility is that he just became too wrapped up in his role as an undercover agent, and perhaps didn't think he needed the help. On Monday the 16th, 1977, 2 days after Nairak went missing, the Provisional IRA released a statement in En Public saying, quote, "They had captured and executed an SAS man who revealed to them much information which they will now respond to accordingly." This statement was ultimately determined to be bogus, as Nairak's killers admitted he gave nothing away. But at the time it was alarming for the British security forces. The SAS and the 14th Intelligence knew the secret information that Nairak was privy to. And as a result of this statement, operations north and south of the border were terminated, because they couldn't confirm or exclude any possibility of any current missions being compromised. John Parker writes that on the Republican side of things, there was a lot of anger in how the night played out. Inside sources in the Provisionals were furious that Nairak had been executed so swiftly. A captive of that quality could have been kept for weeks and would have had immense bargaining power, or he could have been tortured for longer in effort to extract more information from him. Instead, he was brutally murdered after a clumsy interrogation by individuals who had been drinking all day. And when the news emerged that one of the executioners imitated a priest, this was quite a PR embarrassment for the IRA. At this period of the Troubles, the nationalist community felt hatred towards the British Army, and there was little to no pity when a British soldier lost their life on the streets of Northern Ireland. However, many were aghast at the brutality of Nairak's murder, even some members of the public in Armagh. An elderly man who drank at the Three Steps pub said to author Joe Parker, quote, "I'm not sad when any Brit bastard got shot round here, but I couldn't help it. I was sorry for Nairak." But not every nationalist felt sympathy for Nairak. Sinn Féin's Jim McAllister stated in a Tribune article in 2009, quote, "He wasn't an ordinary young soldier, deserving compassion, who found himself in an unfortunate circumstance. He was a member of the British intelligence services, suspected of involvement in several murders himself." In the end, the British and RUC forces conducted an intensive search for Nairak's body. All suspects and informants were questioned at great length, and despite all the resources they had, nothing was found on either side of the border. It was like he vanished into thin air. His family appealed to the killers, as fellow Catholics, to give him a proper Christian burial, but still it yielded nothing. In 1979, Nairak was awarded the posthumous George Cross. Over the years, searches would continue and inquiries would be made. And there were whispers that he was buried by the River Fleury, or that he was interned at the woods in Ravensdale. There were an incredible amount of theories, but three do stand out. The first is that shortly after his death, a well-respected Republican farmer who owned a portion of land in Ravensdale went to the higher command of the Provisionals and demanded that the body be moved, as his dogs were trying to dig up the remains. This apparently was swiftly enacted upon, and he was exhumed and then buried deeper in the Republic of Ireland. A second theory, which is significantly more chilling, was made by former Provisional IRA member Eamon Collins. Collins suggested that Nairak's body could never be found, as it was taken to a farm in South Armagh and put into a meat grinder at the behest of a terrifying Provisional IRA figure in the county. An intensive forensic test was carried out at this establishment, but this was ruled out as no evidence of human blood could be found. A third theory was put forward by former letter bomber Shane Doherty, is that the silence around Nairak's body is intentional and that it will probably only be revealed when the British security forces will reveal their touts or informers, which led to the Loch Gall ambush, which was covered back in season 2. 2017 was the 40th anniversary of Nairac's death. An exhaustive investigation was carried out, which proved to be unsuccessful, despite excavating the grounds in Ravensdale. A year after Nairac's murder, Liam Towson, the 24-year-old joiner and low-ranking provisional IRA member, was captured and sentenced to life in prison. Apparently, Liam went hysterical while in RUC custody, screaming, quote, "I shot the British soldier, I shot the soldier." And according to Kerr, he went on to scream, "Go on and give me the fucking rope. Go on, give me the fucking rope." After Towson was arrested, the others were brought into custody. Thomas Morgan, Daniel O'Rourke, and Jared Fearon were also charged with murder. Michael McCoy and Owen Rocks were charged with kidnapping and aiding an offender. A year after his release, Morgan would die in a drunken car crash. Daniel O'Rourke would go on after his sentence to become a prominent member of Sinn Féin. The others, Terence McCormack, Kevin Crilly, and Patrick Maguire, fled to the United States. The three remained on the run there, and in 2017 received amnesty letters. Only McCormack has ever spoken out of the murder of Robert Nairac, with his face hidden, speaking to Dara McIntyre in 2007, saying, quote, "I am absolutely ashamed of what happened that night. I am disgusted with myself." After 12 years, Towson returned to Armagh and to this day refuses to speak to journalists about the events on that night. The last and strangest feature in this episode is this. An inquest and coroner's report of Nairac by Dundalk coroner Thomas Scully in 1978. It is bizarre indeed to conduct a coroner's report without the body being present, and yet the report went ahead. In the report, Scully was heavily dependent on court reports and testimony, yet Scully recorded the death on the 18th of May 1977, which was over 4 days after Towson executed him. Many journalists and investigators have tried to find out why, but the Ministry of Defence have remained tight-lipped on this matter. To this day, we are left with more questions than answers. And due to the secret nature of Nairac and his role, we are still in the dark. Unlike the conflict itself, the name Nairac still divides people. To his friends and colleagues, he was a fearless hero that was trying to gather information. But to his enemies, he was a reckless fantasist who had become a victim of his own ego. Either way, someone must know where Nairac is buried. Whether they share that information with his family, only time will tell. Thanks, and see you next time. This episode was written by John Livingstone. John is a master's graduate in international relations, specializing in the Troubles. He has been researching this topic heavily for 7 years. And if you're interested in anything related to the topic, you can learn more over at the Troubles Archive on Instagram. The Patreon is a great way to show your support. I release the episodes there early, and I also put out a companion video with each episode. On Patreon, the episodes are also completely ad-free, and you can listen on your own personal RSS feed on your podcast player. I'll also be posting there the full show notes for every episode. You can support the podcast over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. Alternatively, if you'd like to support the podcast in a once-off fashion, you can do that over at buymeacoffee.com/thetroublespodcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving reviews or simply telling your friends. It all helps.